Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Patrick Vitale, author of Nuclear Suburbs, Cold War Technoscience, and the Pittsburgh Renaissance, published this year by the University of Minnesota Press. Dr. Vitale, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Stentor. It's really nice to be here and to get the chance to talk to you today.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Okay, so I'm a geographer. I'm an assistant professor of geography at Eastern Connecticut State University. And, you know, by way of this book, my background or how I got into this book is that I grew up in the suburbs of Pittsburgh in one of the communities that I write about. So I grew up in the eastern suburbs in a community that had a significant number of nuclear engineers living in it. There were, of our five immediate neighbors on our little block, three of them were nuclear engineers, which obviously as a child wasn't something I thought very much about. It was a very sort of very typical suburb, very white, very middle class, and, you know, full of nuclear engineers. And I didn't really think very much about that. And then I got into doing work on historical geography in Pittsburgh over a sort of very long trajectory. And ended up doing my PhD in Toronto, and this book emerged out of that. So it kind of went back and looked at that place that I grew up and investigated why it is that I grew up in the neighborhood where I grew up and, you know, what the social and political characteristics of that place are.
Okay, so to kind of set the scene here, the book is about the so-called Pittsburgh Renaissance. So could you tell our listeners what the Pittsburgh Renaissance is and maybe a bit about how your book challenges maybe some of the conventional narratives about what happened during that period of the city's history?
Sure. So there's been multiple renaissances. Pittsburgh is a city that has been somewhat obsessed with declaring moments of renewal renaissances over the last now 70 years. So I don't know how we're counting these days, but we're probably on our third or fourth renaissance in the city. The first renaissance is the most influential one, and this is the one immediately after World War II. And it's a long story. I'll try to tell it as quickly as I can. In this renaissance, what happens is the city's elite, who are largely the leaders of the major industrial companies, so U.S. Steel, Westinghouse, Alcoa, PPG, and the region's banks, Mellon Bank in particular, and Richard King Mellon, who was the, you know, the family behind Mellon Bank, formed an organization called the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. And the goal of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development was to transform the city's built environment, its natural environment, and its economy. And there was an article that I really like in Fortune magazine that described it as an experiment in survival for the Pittsburgh region. And what they meant by that was that it was an attempt to transform an industrial city into a more modern, more post-industrial economy that was more suited to the economy of the post-war period. And so what the Allegheny Conference did is it led this broad effort to remake really many characteristics of Pittsburgh. Pollution control was one of the big things they were involved in. Flood control was one of the things they were involved in. Remaking the city, urban renewal, clearing neighborhoods that they saw as undesirable that were largely Black and working class were other aspects of this Renaissance. And the final element of the Renaissance that I uncover in my research a little bit of this first Renaissance is an effort to transform or move the economy away from manufacturing and towards what we might consider post-industrial activities. So these are things like medicine, higher education, and research and development. And that's where my story really takes up that particular aspect of the Renaissance that no one has really written about before, which is how it is that the city's leaders try to foster the growth of research and development in the region.
Okay. So one of the major literatures that your book is in conversation with is the science and technology studies literature. And you mention in your introduction, you say, if you wanted to learn about nuclear engineers in their labs, then you have like a whole shelf of books that's been done on that aspect. But what you wanted to do was to focus on what nuclear engineers were doing outside of their labs, in their homes and communities. So why is it important to see this other side of the scientific activity?
Yeah, I think that every profession to some degree is shaped by their social environments that they live in and the social context that, shapes their thinking and their community. So this isn't a story that we could just tell about scientists and engineers, but what is a particular characteristic of scientists and engineers oftentimes is that they've tended to develop systems of thought that eliminate the context from the work that they do. Donna Haraway has this idea that scientists assume a kind of view from nowhere, right? Or a God trick, she calls it. And one of the things that I was trying to do in this book is to demonstrate that there were particular characteristics of Pittsburgh during the Cold War that allowed for scientists and engineers to do their work. Now, what I'm not trying to say here is that the way that they designed a reactor in a certain way was determined by the fact that they lived in the suburbs. That would be, if that is the case, I did not uncover that in my research. But every element of scientists and engineers' lives was reproduced through the social environments that they lived in the suburbs, and in a city that was being transformed in this moment in the 1950s and 1960s in order to make it more appealing to scientists and engineers. So whether in their laboratories or in the suburbs where they were living or the city where they were oftentimes recreating, they were quite privileged subjects in this moment in time. And what I wanted to do in the book was to suggest ways that science and technology studies could engage a little bit more with the world outside of the laboratory and how it is that that world is also essential to the work of technoscience. And that world, I think, is very rarely visible within the field of science and technology studies.
Okay. And in your discussion of that world outside, you bring in kind of an intersectional kind of perspective, and you look at the role of things like race and gender and class in constructing this world. And so I want to pick up first on the gender dimension. I almost wondered when I was starting this book if the nuclear in the title was sort of a pun on the idea of the nuclear family, since we're talking about this class of white male scientists and engineers who are kind of trying to form this, the 1950s Leave It to Beaver kind of households in the suburbs. So what is the role that gender played in the situations that you're writing about in the book?
Gender played a major role in the nuclear scientists and engineers' lives and in their work. One thing to say right off the back is that despite my efforts to find women nuclear engineers and scientists to interview, I was unable to do so. And that was a characteristic of the field in the 1950s and 1960s. Most of my interviews were with nuclear engineers and scientists in the 1950s and 1960s, and there were few women working in the field at that time. Many of the women who were working in that field at the time, when they had professional degrees, were oftentimes still being relocated to less prestigious roles within the laboratory. So those few women that did work in as scientists and engineers in the laboratory oftentimes were not treated the same as male scientists and engineers. But there were very few of them. I mean, I was unable to locate a single one. So that was one thing, is just that the field was very much a masculine, male-dominated field. And that's something I talk about quite a lot in the latter sections of the book. The second thing to note about gender is that these men who are working as nuclear engineers and scientists were fully supported by the labor of women at home. And it wasn't just, you know, in the classic ways that we think about women supporting men's work in these 1950s stereotypical suburbs, right? Caring for children and cleaning homes and cooking dinner. All of that was more often than not completely true. But oftentimes also, especially when these engineers worked in more managerial roles, their partners, their female partners, who they were always married, so they were always wives, were providing all kinds of really professional support for them in their work. So for example, if an engineer relocated overseas to work on a reactor that Westinghouse was developing overseas, the company would oftentimes interview the wife to make sure that she was equipped to handle the rigors of living abroad. One of the male engineers that I interviewed, his wife sat in on the interview, and she explained to me that Westinghouse actually had her write a guide on how to relocate a family because she was so good at doing this. So there was not just the unpaid work at the home that was supporting nuclear engineers and their ability to go and work oftentimes very long hours in the laboratories, but also wives were oftentimes providing really like logistical support for these men in their professional lives.
Okay, so I want to actually pick up then on something you mentioned there about, you know, these reactors being developed in Pittsburgh by the engineers working there, but then they're being exported all over the world. And, you know, some of these people then are going overseas as part of that. So you really portray the development of technoscience in Pittsburgh as being not just about, you know, a renaissance for Pittsburgh and something that is reshaping this particular city, but there's also kind of a geopolitical project embedded in that with the way that nuclear technology was being developed after the Second World War. So could you talk a little more about that connection between the specific place that you're writing about in the book and this broader geopolitical field that it's connected to?
Yeah, there's a historian of scientists named John Krieg, and he has written extensively about the geopolitical uses of nuclear technology for the United States through the Atoms for Peace program and other programs. So there's two really key elements to this story, I think. I'm going to simplify it here for purposes of making this as clear as possible and as short of time as possible. So Westinghouse was the company that made nuclear technology in Pittsburgh. And Westinghouse really made two main products that were sort of elements of nuclear technology. One was a nuclear reactor for power plants, and the other was a nuclear reactor for the propulsion of naval ships. Now, each of these had a purpose for the U.S. Internationally. The reactor that powered ships would power aircraft carriers and submarines. So they were really very direct tools of American imperialism around the world. The submarines were a key counter to the threat of nuclear war from the Soviet Union. It was another element of the United States nuclear deterrence. But equally important, these reactors also powered aircraft carriers. And the ability of the United States to position aircraft carriers all around the world allowed it to engage in wars in places like Vietnam and later in Afghanistan and Iraq. One characteristic of a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier is it very rarely ever has to refuel. It's a period of many, 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 many years. So this means that they really become very key elements of the U.S.'s military infrastructure. But also nuclear power plants were also a form for the U.S. to exert its influence abroad. And that was because the U.S. would export both fuel and the reactors themselves in a way to exert greater influence in places like Europe and other parts of the world. Largely, most of these reactors went to Europe, to Japan, and I think to a lesser extent, to Korea. So providing power to these countries allowed the U.S. to build relationships with them, but it also created an excellent market for U.S. companies like Westinghouse, where they made a great deal of money, particularly selling nuclear fuel to countries abroad.
Okay. And then kind of connected to that, there's a thread going through the book about things being hidden. So you get the sort of official or popular story about what's going on that kind of hides the unsavory aspects of life that either things depend on or the consequences that ensue for them. So would you be able to talk a little more about the role of that secrecy or hiding played in the formation of the landscape of Pittsburgh during this era and about the sort of role of uncovering that your book is doing?
I think the major secret that the book addresses is probably not one that's something that's all that secretive to us in the present moment, and that is the degree to which white, college-educated, male engineers and scientists are supported by an array of advantages, whether it is intergenerational wealth or access to government money to go to school, or the ability to buy homes in communities where those communities accrue value, or the support of living in a patriarchal society where they rely heavily on women to reproduce their daily existence, or living in a city that is being reimagined around them and is really valuing them on a daily basis. So that, you know, nuclear engineers and scientists, unlike steel workers in this moment or unlike coal miners in this moment, are really being celebrated as really the most desirable citizens in Pittsburgh. Now, all of that stuff, I think, to all of us today looking back on this is hopefully many of those different things that I've just talked about are not secrets. But what is somewhat remarkable is the degree to which they were oftentimes secrets to the nuclear scientists and engineers themselves. And I think that's the key thing that's really rendered invisible in a lot of their work and their thinking about their work, is the degree to which they believe fundamentally that they got to where they did because of their own abilities and their own efforts, and because they are expertly trained experts. They're scientists and engineers, and they know how to build a nuclear reactor, and that's why it is that they're doing what they're doing. And what is oftentimes quite invisible to them is all of the different structures that are themselves oftentimes violent and unjust that facilitate their ability to do their work. So I think that's the primary thing. You know, it's not like it's some top secret Russian spy or something that's working in, or, you know, some secret facility that's supporting their work. It's really the society itself that is allowing them to go about building these reactors, but is oftentimes quite invisible to them in their own reflections about their lives and their work.
Yeah, I think those are sometimes the most impactful secrets are the ones that aren't really being, you know, kept top secret. They're out there if you look for it, but people just render it invisible by not paying attention to it. And then it, you know, gets sort of shuffled off to the side until someone comes along and says, hey, we need to look at this, you know, dimension to life here.
Yeah, that's very true. And I would say that one thing, it wasn't as though they had been trained to think about these questions, and it wasn't as though they spent a great deal of time reflecting on the communities where they were living. So many of them, when I was oftentimes one of the first people who ever asked, you know, why did you buy a house in this community? And they were oftentimes really flummoxed by this question for a period of time, and we would have to work through it together to kind of finally get them to the conclusion that they didn't choose their house because it was the closest to the laboratory, because oftentimes it wasn't the closest to the laboratory, but that is oftentimes what they first told me. And then I would pull out a map and be and say, you know, it actually wasn't. It had to do very much with assumptions about class and race and what were the suitable communities for scientists and engineers to live in. So they were making decisions to live in segregated communities, but they really weren't ever really aware that they were doing that in oftentimes a very clear way to them.
Yeah. And so it seems like with some of these processes that, and, you know, this might be a little bit of a curveball question for you, but I'm, you know, interested in your thoughts on this, that this in some ways could be seen as kind of a story about environmental justice or environmental injustice, because we've got a period at which we have this really conscious attempt to clean up the city, to move away from steel that has this reputation as this very dirty industry. And, you know, the Pittsburgh has this, you know, terrible pollution problem, and to, you know, kind of clean up the city, move to what was seen as this, you know, industry, you know, nuclear as this very clean, kind of the opposite of steel in a lot of ways, kind of industry that's really tied into things like creation of these, you know, all white suburbs. And, you know, at the same time, you're getting these urban renewal projects that are just decimating some of the African American neighborhoods in the city. So I guess I kind of just am interested in your thoughts about seeing this as an environmental justice issue.
Yeah, I think that it is on probably on two different dimensions. One, the degree to which when Pittsburgh was remade through this first Renaissance, it was really remade for its white middle class residents. And so it was an environmental justice issue, clearly, and to the extent to which those residents were having amenities built for them. Those residents were not having their homes taken from them and their communities taken from them and torn down. And that's one element of the environmental justice issue. Another element that I don't get into as much as I could have in the book is that each of these men that I interviewed was a serious advocate for nuclear power. Oftentimes it kind of ranged, there was a range of advocacy. Some were really very involved politically in promoting nuclear power. They spoke on college campuses, they were members of professional organizations. Many of them admitted that they, what they said, quote unquote, voted the nuclear ticket, which meant that they voted for whatever candidate they thought would be best for a nuclear industry that they oftentimes saw as embattled by the public. But they were never really able to acknowledge the problems of nuclear power. And the problems of nuclear power are oftentimes very removed from their lives. They designed the reactor, but they didn't mine the uranium, which is oftentimes a very dangerous activity. They didn't have to live around the waste that nuclear reactors produced. They themselves didn't live particularly proximate to any nuclear reactors. The closest nuclear reactor was, 30 or 40 miles away. So again, they were advocating for this technology, but they were not themselves. They were very insulated from the negative or harmful effects that technology had on the environment.
Okay, and you've made a few references as we've gone along here to some of the interviews that you did. So I want to kind of drill down on that a little bit, because in the book, you don't hit us with a big capital M methodology chapter. So I was hoping you kind of pull together some of the strands of how you actually went about researching this book, how you compiled all of the information that you base it on.
Yeah, so part of it was archival, and I could talk about that more later. The oral histories were driven largely by a snowball sample. And what I did was I went, as soon as I started doing the research in 2007, I think I started, I went and interviewed my neighbor across the street. And the interviews are all anonymous, so I won't tell that person's name. And that person then, although that person I actually don't quote at all in the book. And that person then introduced me to many, many of their colleagues, and they introduced me to more colleagues and more colleagues and more colleagues. And eventually I got over, my research started in the eastern suburbs. And in the eastern suburbs, typically nuclear engineers worked in the commercial power division because that was based in the eastern suburbs. But eventually I got more over into the southern suburbs where the Bettis Laboratory is based. The Bettis Laboratory made reactors for the military, for submarines and aircraft carriers. And there eventually, for a period of time in the community of Pleasant Hills, I would interview somebody and they would say, oh, you got to talk to my neighbor in the backyard. And I would sometimes, literally walk around the block and go and interview their neighbor on the same day. There were some days where I actually had to bring multiple batteries for my recorder because, I was doing quite a few of these interviews in a day as they one person introduced me to the other person, introduced me to the other person. The methodology was a pretty basic oral history methodology where I would sit down with them. I would ask them to tell me a bit about their life, what kind of work they did, how they ended up at Westinghouse, then how they ended up in Pittsburgh if they had moved from outside of the region. And usually throughout that process, there would be digressions where they would say something interesting. I would ask them a little bit more about it. The narrative would move off in a direction. And after that had played itself out, we would come back to talking a little bit more about their lives. That was the methodology. And that's how I found people. I don't think that if there's a really scientific orientation to oral history, I don't have it. My approach to oral history is just to ask people to tell me about their lives. Like any person who's doing interviews, I had a set of questions that I wanted to ask, and I always kept those in the back of my mind. So I always wanted to ask, what were your thoughts if you worked on weapons? How did you feel about those weapons? Did you have strong feelings about communism or the Soviet Union, those kinds of questions. But largely, it was just asking people to tell you about their life in a very informal sense. And for the most part, people were very, very enthusiastic to talk. And this was a real contrast to earlier research I had done. I had done earlier oral histories with steel workers in the Mon Valley. And that research was looking at how it is that class identities of steelworkers changed as they moved into the environment of the suburbs. And I found that research very challenging because despite my efforts to convince steelworkers that they had an interesting story to tell, because of the, Richard Sennett has this term called the hidden injuries of class. And because they had internalized oftentimes an understanding that their stories weren't worth telling, it was oftentimes like pulling teeth to get them to really open up about their lives. That was less often a problem with many of the nuclear engineers and scientists I talked to. They they were a bit more egotistical. They weren't arrogant, but they were very happy to talk about themselves. So they were oftentimes very forthcoming. It wasn't hard to get most people to talk about, what they had done and where they had lived and things of that sort.
Okay. And you mentioned there's an archival component to it too. Was it difficult to get a hold of some of these documents and records for, an industry that I would imagine is, kind of sensitive, and there's, political dimensions to the military parts of it. So, what kind of records did you look at, and what was the process like of getting access to those things?
Yeah, there's two different ways that I use the archival sources. One is to look at how the city's elite reimagined the region around scientists and engineers. And those records all come from an organization that I talked about a little bit ago called the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. That was the organization that led Pittsburgh's Renaissance. Their archives are available at the Heinz History Center, or I think it's now, they have an archive there. They've changed the name recently, but I think it's called the John Detter Library and Archives. And that's a really good collection that there's a lot that can be done with it by other researchers still. It's big, it's pretty intact, and that was very useful. The other collection I used a lot and was much less useful, unfortunately, was the Heinz History Center also has a Westinghouse collection. But that was largely the public relations materials of Westinghouse. So it's around 450 archival boxes. Those of you who've done archival research know the kind of box I'm talking about, like a standard file box, which is a big collection, but not a big collection for a massive corporation that was a Fortune 500 company that existed for, 100 years or more. So a lot of materials were missing from that collection. Those were materials that Westinghouse had saved because they considered them valuable public relations materials and had transferred over to the Heinz History Center. As a result, I didn't have access to correspondence. I didn't have access to decision-making documents, financial materials. All of that is somewhere. I imagine it still exists somewhere, but it was not materials that I was able to access. Westinghouse is no longer Westinghouse. The company no longer exists. It was bought by, I'm not really sure. I can't remember the transformation, but it became CBS, and then it became Viacom, and then it became CBS again, because it always had a media component to it. And so the industrial core of the company is just no longer there. It's all been sold off. And their archives, I think, still exist somewhere, but they're not publicly available. So the materials that I had from Westinghouse, when they were useful, when they were really rich, they pertain to a particular historic moment that the company wanted to document. So the company made an atom smasher, which was this what they sold as a cutting-edge research facility in the 1930s. There's really rich materials about that atom smasher. The company built a major research center along the parkway in Churchill. There's lots and lots of correspondence and details about that research center because the company wanted to document its history. And so I wrote where the company left records. That was the decision I had to make because there wasn't, it was impossible to fill in the holes that were many in this archival collection. Fortunately, there were a couple of different areas that I was able to build, an argument around. But those were because the company had intentionally kept those records. And there was very, very, very little relating to defense or to the Bettis Laboratory. So all of the work that I talk about Bettis is drawing largely from the oral histories, not from the materials of the company itself.
Okay. So now changing gears a little bit, you mentioned way back at the beginning that, Pittsburgh's been through a whole bunch of renaissances. We're on, three or four now, depending on who's doing the counting. And so I'm interested in what kinds of lessons you think that the Pittsburgh of today might draw from what you've written about the sort of original Pittsburgh Renaissance.
So I grew up in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, and then I went to Pitt in the 1990s. So between 1998 and 2001, I was there. And that was a time period where the city was really dominated by an understanding that young people were not attracted to the city, and that they were leaving the city, and that the city needed to make efforts to attract young people. And if you were in Pittsburgh at that time period, young people were a kind of central character. And if you were actually young and you lived in Pittsburgh, you were like, wait, there's quite a few of us here, you know, why are we not being, why are we so valuable? And also, why aren't those of us who are actually living here considered valuable? Of course, the very character of the young person was itself a racialized and classed character. A young person was a educated professional of some sort. And so that kind of framed my understanding of the city, because that wasn't the first time that kind of discourse existed, right? There was multiple moments throughout the city's history where there was a need to attract outsiders to the city in order to allow for its economy to grow, which would then in turn benefit all Pittsburghers. And at the same time that I was living in Pittsburgh in the 1990s, there was somebody who was really selling this snake oil all around the world, and that was Richard Florida. And so Richard Florida, who came out of Pittsburgh, who came out of CMU at this time period, really developed a theory that was the same operational theory that the city's planners and leaders had been using for years and years and years, which is that if you attract the creative class, or if you attract young people, or if you attract scientists and engineers, then we will, or knowledge workers, or whatever, tech workers today, then we will cause the economy to grow, and all Pittsburghers will benefit from that process. And that's still going on in this city. And the fundamental lesson that I hope that we know already, but if we don't know, I hope people will draw from my book, is that that does not work. It does not prove to rise all boats. What happens is, you know, the people who are being targeted and attracted to the region may accrue some benefit from moving to the area. It's possible that they do. But the primary beneficiaries of this are oftentimes the major companies that are based in the region. So it's the banks, it's the companies like Westinghouse, or today the companies like Uber that have facilities in the region. So I think that this narrative that we attract a desirable citizen to the city in order to cause the city to grow and everybody to prosper is incredibly problematic. And one that we need to dispose of. I think that as Pittsburgh has been, you know, quote unquote, discovered in the last 10 years or so, I think this narrative has become less palpable in the region. But it had a good 65-year run there where, you know, every decade or so, there was a discovery that we needed to attract people to the city again and again and again. The second element I would say that, and this is another lesson I think that we should draw from Pittsburgh, is the degree to which the city is always being remade again and again and again and again and again. And I think that there's probably a lesson that we can draw there, which is that, you know, this remaking is never really addressing the actual fundamental problems that exist in the region, which are a history of racism, which are a history of environmental justice, which are a history of exploitation of workers, which are a history of, you know, patriarchal social relations that have really shaped the region for many, many, many centuries, or depending on the issue, a century or so. And that sort of continual effort to remake the region oftentimes masks what actually should be remade, which is the fundamentally unjust and unequal social processes that shape the region.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds right on to me. As someone living in Pittsburgh, I hear some of these same narratives you're talking about attracting people to the city. And I also can see that, you know, we're sort of ending up with there's Google and there's the rest of Pittsburgh, and they happen to be located at the same latitude and longitude, and that's about it. With this, you know, emphasis on the current tech economy and the current iteration of Renaissance that we're in today. So that sounds pretty accurate there for the city as we know it today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tech economy is always going to be in its capitalist permutation, is always going to be based in inequality between different types of workers. And so to the degree to which the discourse of the tech economy prioritizes the interests of a certain set of workers, those who are college educated, it's always going to produce injustices. I think you can see that playing out very clearly right now in Pittsburgh neighborhoods like Lawrenceville or the Strip District, where, you know, there is, again, a good deal of displacement of working class people and people of color, particularly from Lawrenceville, as that neighborhood is being sort of reimagined around, technology industries of various sorts. It's the same story that's been going on in the region for 70 years, for sure.
Yeah.
Or longer.
Yeah. So to wrap up our interview here, we always like to ask what you're working on next. So what kind of projects are you taking up now that this book is out?
Well, COVID-19 has really thrown research for a loop for most people, and certainly for me as well. There's two projects that I'm hoping to, one that I had already started and then was paused by the pandemic, and another that I'm really looking forward to getting started with in the next year or so. The one project, I live in a town called Willimantic. It's in Connecticut. It's where the university that I'm based is located. And Willimantic is, it's called the Thread City. So it was the former center of thread manufacturing in the United States, cotton thread manufacturing. And the cotton thread industry is no longer here. So what's left is a deindustrialized community. It's one of the poorest communities in Connecticut. And it has a university in it. That's a small university where I teach, Eastern Connecticut State University. One of the things I've been really interested in researching in this town is the role of policing in urban image making. So the city is very intensely policed. It's a small city of around 20,000 people, but there's a very large police department. That police department is heavily engaged largely in policing what we might refer to as quality of life offenses. So, the number one offenses or arrests in the community are breach of peace and disorderly conduct. So these are largely crimes of being poor. And what I'm interested in doing for this research project is to look at the role of the police in policing poverty and the way in which they're enlisted in order to make this community that I live in, which is a poor, deindustrialized community, more competitive economically. So the goal of the city's leaders is to use the police force to create quality of life to attract investment and people to move to this community. So that's one project that I had started doing work on and then got kind of crushed by the pandemic. But I'm hoping to get back to it soon. The other project that I'm really interested in getting started on is a project on Hartford and the insurance industry. And I'm really interested in looking and tracing the role of the insurance industry in shaping Hartford over the last 140 or so years, or a little bit more than that, that the insurance industry has been based in Hartford. Hartford is a really, really stark city in terms of inequity. you know, it's parts of it are extremely poor, parts of it are extremely wealthy, particularly its suburbs. And I'm really curious in doing for this project, I'm interested in looking at the kind of city that the insurance industry makes, and how it is that it forms a metropolitan region that's incredibly unjust, and what that has to do with how it is that the insurance industry operates and how people who work in the insurance industry think about questions of risk in the social environment. So that's research that I'm really, that's like my idea of what I hope my next big project will be. Unfortunately, if the Connecticut State University system gets its way, we'll soon be teaching a 5-5 up here. And if that is the case, then it may be a long, long time till I or anyone else at our institution gets to do research. So hopefully that doesn't happen, but we'll see.
All right. Yeah. Hopefully that doesn't happen, and hopefully it doesn't give the Pennsylvania state system any ideas. They tried to pull that one a little while back when we had our contract renegotiations, and we managed to stop that. So I hope you're able to do that too and get on with some of those research projects. And if those turn into books, we'd love to have you back on to talk about them.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's been really nice to talk to you. And, you know, good luck in that continued fight with your own state university system.
Yeah.
It's a difficult time.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. You just heard a conversation with Patrick Vitale, author of Nuclear Suburbs, Cold War Technoscience and the Pittsburgh Renaissance, published this year by the University of Minnesota Press.